Hey, it's Peter here with MyFSHD on this beautiful Nevada Day. What's Nevada Day, you ask? Well, it's the day Nevada became a state, October 31st, 1864. And yeah, it's actually particularly significant in American history. And we celebrate it actually on the last Friday of October. Everyone gets the day off, unless you're in my lab and they're working. But here it is on Saturday and having the parade in Carson City. I'm hanging out in lab for a while, doing the podcast, and then we're going to watch the Rugby World Cup final between the Springboks and the All Blacks. Can't wait to see that. That's coming up at noon today. But what is Nevada Day? Well, got to tell you, I'm back in 1864, in the middle of the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln, president of the United States, which you may have heard of, unless you've been educated in the U.S. in the current system. He was up for re-election and having a tough time, actually. And so there were three territories, Nevada, Colorado, and Nebraska, Colorado, and Nevada, that could become states. And there was, you had to go through this long process to become a state. And only Nevada came through. Nebraska and Colorado, they couldn't get it done. Nevada sent their entire constitution by telegraph. Is the largest telegraph message ever sent. The whole constitution from Nevada to Washington, D.C., because if you've ever been out here, that's the basically from west coast to east coast, 3,000 plus miles. And so you're not totally, the mail was about the same pace it is today, but which means it takes a long time to get there. But anyway, so what that did, the reason it was historically significant is because they were then able to vote on November 8th in the presidential election and provide President Lincoln with three additional electoral votes, which is part of our wonky system to elect presidents, and ensure that he gets reelected. It also ensured that, the battle continued against the Confederacy, and the 13th Amendment was ratified, which abolished slavery. Okay. And really, I gotta tell you, not sure how much of that would have gotten done without Nevada coming to the call. In addition, we also, we're not just a desert, we're a high mountain desert in the north where I live. Gorgeous, beautiful, hiking, fishing, beautiful place. In the south, regular desert, Las Vegas. It's gamblers and hookers, and it's basically typical desert. And but we actually have a ton of natural resources: silver, gold, and now lithium. And so we contributed $400 million worth of silver to the North, to the Union Civil War cause, funded actually the Civil War. A lot of it, that was a lot of money back then, 1864. I know it's a chump change nowadays. But it's a few rocket launchers, but back then it was a significant contribution. And so so that's where our state motto, Battle Born, comes from. No battles were ever fought in Nevada, but we entered the Union as a free state, meaning no slavery, and in support of abolishing slavery, and because of the Civil War that was going on. Our motto is meant to signify that strength, resilience, and courage of people everywhere, not just in Nevada, people everywhere. Okay. And Nevadans quite proud of it's a tough place to live. It's at least especially back then in pioneer days. But speaking of strength, resilience, and courage of people, I want to give a big shout out to all of my Jewish friends out there that are having a particularly tough time, at least in the U.S. And of course in Israel, having a really tough time, all my Israeli friends. We've helped we help families all over the world. We've helped a number of families figure out their FSHD status in Israel. In fact, just before this podcast, I sent off a report to some of our friends in Israel who wanted to know about their son, even with what's going on. People want to know. Honestly, we've helped a number of Palestinian families as well in the West Bank and in Hebron and such. And we help everybody everywhere. Okay. So we don't care about people's politics. We don't care about people's race, religion, anything. We just, if you need help, you want to learn about your FSHD status, we're here to help you. I figure that as FSHDers, we're united by our fight against FSHD to find a cure, to find treatments, to improve diagnostics, really to help each other out as a community, raise money, raise awareness. There's just so much that needs to be done, it's just for good. But as with the Civil War, when sometimes you have to have battles and war and violence in order to do what's right. And after the terrorist attack performed by Hamas on Israel back on October 8th, or October 7th, actually, and 8th, Israel has had to respond. And I want to just make it clear, I absolutely support Israel's response and declaration of war against Hamas and to eliminate terrorism, and absolutely unequivocally condemn Hamas and anyone who supports Hamas, because you support terrorism and murder to advance a political agenda. made comments also, about our support for Ukraine against Russia. You do have to pick sides sometimes. And you know what? Here's a case where it's not difficult at all to pick sides. You support terrorism and murder or not. Pretty clear to me. Now, when people say, well, what about, Israel is causing these civilian deaths in Gaza? Why don't you condemn that? That's actually been asked of me at work. Some people in the U.S. seem to think there's no difference. I do condemn those deaths. I condemn those deaths at the hands of Hamas. They are the responsibility of Hamas. The blood of every civilian killed in Gaza is on the hands of Hamas, the leadership, and quite honestly, the Palestinian people that have supported Hamas and terrorism. You support terrorism, this is what happens. You get used as a human shield, this is what happens. Everybody understands how this works. Terrorists attack Israel, they respond. Terrorists do everything in their power to maximize civilian deaths. Israel does everything in their power to minimize civilian deaths, right? Terrorists do this because they know the useful idiots in the U.S. Congress, the useful idiots in the United Nations, the useful idiots in all the Arab countries around the world will come to their defense and say, oh, you must stop this slaughter of these poor, innocent civilians that are basically being used as human shields to hide military targets, okay? Everyone knows how it works. And if your government and your leaders don't value your lives, it's up to you to change your leadership. So I support all of my, just really want to tell you, love and support to all of my Jewish friends. For those of you, I'm sure people don't even know, the contributions of the Jewish community to FSHD is astronomical. It's unmeasurable. I personally don't pay attention to who's Jewish or Black or Hispanic or Asian. You just kind of, people are, I treat everybody as an individual, which is highly frowned upon in academia nowadays. You're supposed to do identity politics. But I still treat people as individuals. But then thinking back on it since these attacks, I was thinking, wow, the contributions of my friends that are Jewish that are in the FSHD space are just enormous, whether it's patient advocacy, awareness, research development, therapeutic development. You name it. In pharma company, biotech companies, in foundations, it's just the contribution from our the Jewish FSHDers is enormous, and thank God for every single one of them. Now, I understand not all of y'all may support me or agree with me in my decision. That's fine. But make it very clear, don't want to get too spend too much time on politics here, but I absolutely unequivocally condemn Hamas, condemn terrorism. I condemn those who support Hamas, whether they are in the U.S. Congress, the United Nations, in U.S. academics, progressive organizations that seem to side with terrorism. Absolutely condemn every damn one of them. Okay, and full support for Israel's right to defend themselves. There's no way that's going to please everybody. But you know what? The best way you can support, in my opinion, the people of Gaza and Palestinian people, is to eliminate terrorism. This is not a war on Muslims. This is not a war on Islam. This is actually not even a war on Palestinians. It is a war against terrorism. Plain and simple. That's what it is. Eliminate terror. You have to eliminate terrorists and terrorism before you'll have any peace or prosperity. That's just how it is. All right. So I'm going to take a short break, and then we are going to talk about apobetalone and some new CRISPR work that's out there, and a little bit about the funding space that's going on. So I'll be back in a sec. I'm not afraid to
Ride, ride on the way. I'll catch you all another day. No, it's just a Tuesday, but this is like a Wednesday. I can make it over the hump. No, I can't make the jump. I don't know what's up, man. What the fuck? She's been coming left and right. I've been dodging day and night. My demons to love, they keep it above. They tell me what's happening, they tell me give up. Some people think it's corny that I'll call them demons. What you want me to call them? My flaws and sins, my realizations. Damn, I can feel real hating. Extensive, but get past my baiting. When I feel jaded, I go and get faded. Help with the situation, don't wanna sell the situation. Know that I get pissed, but that's just bullshit. In the end, it's just gonna be time wasted. Don't get no fuss about you, so why you watch me? I'm just tryna chill and live in peace. They don't wanna press me. Hey, why you wanna press me? Like I'm pasty, seeing your girl like I'm Westy. In the left hand, but this ain't trusty. Married to the shit, like under a belt free. Really quit when I freeze. Every day you spend like groundhog day. It just feels the same. Get on your ass, then I get up. Then I rewind for me to start up. They should do cold, rest of love. Man, I'm out of the fucks. Gotta take a show up.
All right, that was Runaway by our man Jagger the Kid. You know, the only music better than 80s music is my man Jagger. Love it. And you know what? He's up. You can get him now on YouTube, Spotify, any of the streaming services. He's dropping a song a month. That was Runaway. Search JAEGERTHEKIDD and you'll find him. And yeah, he's going to have a whole bunch. My understanding is he drops a whole bunch of videos too every month. Anyway, really creative. Fantastic stuff. That's actually, you know, so many sounds nowadays are just derivative. But you know what? I just laugh, at least as far as I can tell. That's quite the unique sound. Absolutely love it. And it's great that we get to be the world premiere of all of his stuff. That's right. So we're going to have him on the podcast. My FSHDM plugged on the next podcast. All right, so I always try to be responsive to the MyFSHD community. I love the fact that you guys send me emails about what's out there and your questions because y'all seem to be more in touch with kind of the general web than I am, and we're pretty busy. But I do appreciate things coming to my attention. The most common comment I get is your podcast is too long. I'm going to try, it takes me 5 minutes to cook minute rice when I talk, so I'll try to do better. But recently, I got a lot of questions about the same thing, this new paper that came out called Apabetalone, a Clinical Stage Selective BET Inhibitor, Opposes DUX4 Target Gene Expression in Primary Human FSHD Muscle Cells, published in Biomedicines. And this comes out, Christopher Sarsons is the first author. Eulenia Kulikowski is the corresponding senior author. And this comes out of Resverologics Corp. Okay, so it's not an academic paper. It's a company paper, industry paper. Some of you may never have heard of Resverologics. I know them quite well because they have been interested in FSHD for quite a long time, I guess. And I can't remember if they were either stealth or not, but they're not stealth now. And mainly, though, because their wheelhouse is drug development for these things called BET inhibitors. Okay, and that's BET proteins. We're going to talk about those in a sec. They're involved in gene expression, and pretty much every gene that on in the genome has got a bromodomain protein, and the B in BET stands for bromodomain. And so they've been in the cancer space. Now they're getting into some other indications. And their long interest in FSHD is now being publicized. And we'll kind of get through some of the nuts and bolts of what's going on here. Well, first, let's step back. You know, I know the reason you guys are interested because of the word clinical stage. So here is a drug that's in clinic for something else, right? And so it may be applicable to FSHD. And, you know, that's kind of exciting, right? This is a repurposing of a drug, right? It was not developed for FSHD. It's developed for something else, some other indication. Just like losmapimod that Fulcrum has in trial, right? That's a P38 inhibitor that, well, actually gone to trial for, I believe, 11 other indications and failed clinical trial for 11 other indications. But, you know, it's being, you pass certain levels of safety, you have certain levels of confidence on dosing and tolerability in patients when you repurpose a drug. The downside is, again, they're not FSHD specific, right? So as opposed to things like Avidity or Dyne or Epic or even my own lab, or Renogenix, we're all making FSHD specific therapies. This is a case of a repurposing of a therapy that's already out there. There's some benefits, time can go faster, but again, not designed specifically with FSHD in mind. All right, so let's kind of work through this a little bit, get you some of the background. So what is a BET, B-E-T, okay? That is bromodomain and extraterminal domain, okay? That's what the B-E-T stands for. Okay, it's about 110 amino acid structure is a bromodomain, and its function is to recognize acetylated lysines on other proteins. Okay, so I said a lot there for some of you. So you will remember DNA, that's your genetic code, right? Your DNA, you got about 3 billion base pairs of DNA. That's about 2 meters long. It's got to get into a 10 micron, 10 to the minus sixth nucleus in your cell. And it's going to do that by wrapping around these things called histones, which are proteins, okay? So your DNA wraps around these proteins in a coil, and then sort of that's how you get your slinky-like structure, and you compact your genome into the cell, okay? But you can't just do it all willy-nilly. It's actually very organized, and it has to be regulated because you're going to need to access, the cellular machinery is going to need to access the DNA in order to turn genes on and make RNA. Now, when you make RNA, the DNA gets made into RNA, right? So your kind of extended recipe gets compacted into a very specific recipe. That's your RNA, which then goes to the cytoplasm and is translated by ribosomes into protein. So the protein is encoded, the information on what protein to make is encoded in your DNA, and the message is transmitted through the mRNA. Okay, so now you only have about 40,000 to 60,000 genes, depending on who's counting. You're pretty complex. Just making a protein is just only part of the deal. You know, once you make a protein, think of it as a potato. Okay, let's say your protein is a potato. You can modify this protein with post-translational modifications, okay? So if you think about it as translation is making the protein, decoding the mRNA and adding in all the amino acids and linking them together, alanine, lysine, proline, blah, 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 arginine, link it together, make the protein. Once you have that protein, then due to signals in the cell that are transmitted through the cell, those proteins can be modified with like acetylation, methylation, ribosylation, sumalation, you name it, almost any elation, ubiquitin elation, which then changes the protein, can change its localization, can change its function, can change its stability, right? You can lead to protein degradation, can lead to protein to maybe go out to the membrane, can lead to a protein becoming suddenly active, or can inactivate the protein. Okay, so one protein can have, for example, if you think about your potato, you could put a toothpick in it, you can put an umbrella, a little cocktail umbrella in it, you could put a toothpick with an olive in it, decorate up your potatoes with all these toothpicks sticking in there, and you can imagine that each one of these presents a unique surface to the cellular, the nuclear machinery, right? So When you're thinking about histone proteins that the DNA is wrapped around, these are actually prime targets of post-translational modifications. So all the DNA is wrapped around these histones, okay? But all these histones are not, even though they're the same protein sequence derived from the same DNA sequences, actually, you know, there's four of them, H2A, H2B, H3, and H4, then H1 is a fifth linker histone. So they come from those sequences. But when the DNA gets wrapped around them, it gets organized by these post-translational modifications, like acetylation and methylation. Now, you've heard of methylation before. Same thing goes with DNA. Remember, your DNA sequence can be unmethylated at the FSHD region, in which case it is on, right? It can be expressed, or it can be heavily methylated at the FSHD region, and it is off. So just that small CH3, a methyl group, on your DNA can signal whether or not the gene should be on or off. Same thing with the histone. So it's not just the DNA. It's everything that goes with the DNA, because those DNA code of methylation goes with a histone code of post-translational modifications. Okay, and one of the key codes is histone lysine acetylation. Okay, a little acetyl group on the histones, on these histone tails, of which there's many sites that can be acetylated. So you can have monoacetylation, diacetylation, quad acetylation, lots of acetylation. And when the histones are acetylated, they are associated with genes that are on. So DNA would be unmethylated, histones would be hyperacetylated. And that's kind of a signature of being on, with other additional modifications as well. So what does this all got to do with anything? Well, bromodomains, okay, the B in BET inhibitor, bromodomains are protein domains that recognize an acetylated lysine. Now, they can recognize this on histone proteins and non-histone proteins. It's okay. But what that, you know, indicates, so a lot of these proteins that contain bromodomains, they bind an acetylated histone, but they also bring in other enzymatic activities that can remodel the chromatin or add more acetylation to the region and ramp up gene expression. So histone acetylation and proteins that contain bromodomains tend to go with genes that are on. In fact, just about every gene that is expressed in a cell has a bromodomain protein associated with it. I'm going to have to look at my notes. There are 61 different bromodomains that we know about in the genome, 46 proteins in 8 families, okay? BETs, that's one family of bromodomains, okay? Bromodomain proteins. And so the idea here is that when you want to turn a gene on, you get a little bit of acetylation, okay? You need to remodel the chromatin and increase the histone post-translational modification. So bromodomain-containing proteins are recruited to these sites and then ramp up gene expression, okay? So if you're thinking about the DUX4 gene needs bromodomain proteins to be turned on. And so the idea here in this paper is they're going to make this drug. Now, you know, thinking about your potato with your with your toothpick with like a little cocktail umbrella out there, right? That's your acetyl group stuck into the potato. A bromodomain is going to recognize just that umbrella, okay, on the potato, right? It's not going to recognize any of the other modifications. It's going to recognize that's your acetylysine, okay? And so the idea here is to make a small molecule that is going to fit into the groove on the bromodomain so that it cannot grab onto that umbrella, and so it's not able to be recruited to your potato with the modification. So if you put in a BET inhibitor, it will block the recruitment of the activator proteins required for DUX4 expression. And then if you can't express DUX4, you're not going to get FSHD, right? That's the idea. Okay, let's prevent the activation of DUX4. Now, it's kind of like a little bit of a twist in this paper. One of the things they don't really do is they never actually assay DUX4. You see, it says DUX4 target gene expression. Okay. Now, what is DUX4? Right. We know DUX4 causes FSHD. You know, the DUX4 gene is the FSHD region of your genome, gets transcribed into the DUX4 mRNA, and then translated into the DUX4 protein. The DUX4 protein is a transcriptional activator itself, and it goes and it turns on a bunch of other target genes in the genome, several hundred other genes in the genome. These are the DUX4 target genes that you normally don't want expressed in your muscle. Now, we don't know which of these cause FSHD, any of them, all of them, whatever, but DUX4 target gene expression is a signature of FSHD muscle. Interestingly, Michael Kaiba showed a few years ago that DUX4 protein recruits bromodomain-containing proteins, PCAF and P300, and that is required, that's a different family of bromodomains, to turn on gene expression. So DUX4 protein itself needs bromodomain proteins to turn on DUX4 target genes. Okay. Franz Svedrup, way back in 2013, if I remember correctly, because it was at a meeting where he presented this, showed that if you block some bromodomain proteins with drugs, you can shut down DUX4. Okay. And that was recent, that was published then on a paper by Amy Campbell with Stephen Tapscott and Fran in 2017. And they showed pretty clearly that the family of bromodomain proteins that is connected to expression of the DUX4 gene is the BET family of bromodomain proteins. And so BET inhibitors would be useful tools therapeutically, potentially, for FSHD drugs, right? And that's the whole premise of this paper. Now, remember, don't think about that. It's been around for at least 10 years, right? People have known about this, okay? And so if it's been around for 10 years, and even back then, 10 years ago, the drug that Fran used was called JQ1, and that's actually in this paper as a control. And that was a clinically relevant drug back in 2013. How come 10 years later, we're still just kind of talking about a promising candidate therapeutic for FSHD? In fact, that's the last phrase of the abstract of this paper, is that this drug is a promising candidate therapeutic for FSHD. And so that's because, as you know, as with everything FSHD, the devil's in the details, okay? So an acetylated lysine is actually, it's got a very distinct structure. And bromodomains, the groove of a bromodomain that binds an acetylated lysine is actually a pretty small groove. It's a small modification, a small little bump, right, that is goes into a small little groove, okay? And it's very hard to get specificity, okay? So the initial classes of bromodomain proteins just blocked all bromodomains. Of course, that's going to shut down all gene expression in the cell. And you know, again, those might be tools for studying stuff in the lab, but that's not going to go to clinic. JQ1 was an advance and I think that was done by Novartis back in the day, if I remember correctly. And they were able to say, okay, this is just going to block the BET family, okay? But that's still a large number of proteins. So BET family of proteins, there's two bromodomains, BD1 and BD2, bromodomain 1, bromodomain 2. And JQ1 blocks all bromodomain 1s and all bromodomains 2s. Okay, so it's going to shut off an awful lot of genes in the genome and screw a lot of things up. Now, this is fine for the indications that it's actually being used for. And actually, if you look, you know, what are the indications that JQ1, they call this a pan inhibitor. Well, they're all cancer, multiple myeloma, myofibrosis disease, testes cancer, advanced solid tumors, hematologic malignancies, pediatric cancer, right? And it's basically chemotherapy. And we all know that the issue with chemotherapy is dose-limiting toxicity and side effects. And of course, you're going to get that because these are going to shut down an awful lot of gene expression. Well, on the other hand, when you got cancer, you're only taking chemotherapy for a short time because either you're going to kill the cancer or the cancer is going to kill you or the drug's going to kill you, right? I mean, it's just, you know, speaking as a cancer survivor who did not have to go through chemotherapy, I'm so thankful I didn't have to go through chemotherapy because you're basically, it's poison, it's poison against against the cancer. Right. So if you're thinking about this from an FSHD perspective, a chronic disease where you're going to be on this drug for the rest of your life, okay, BET inhibition now needs to get more specific. Okay. So we know that bromodomain proteins are required for expression of DUX4. In fact, it's not even just the BET one. You know, actually, there's other, you know, my lab, our CRISPR goddess is also an epigenetic goddess. She published a paper back in 2018 where she showed that if you eliminate this protein called BRD2, bromodomain 2 protein, BRD2, BRD3, BAS1A, BAS2A, or BAS2B, all of these proteins, any one of them, if you eliminate them using antisense technology, you shut down DUX4, right? So that actually says that would indicate there's at least five bromodomain proteins that are required for expression of DUX4. Okay. So you don't, can't get too selective. Davida Gabellini showed that ASH1A is required for expression of DUX4 in FSHD. Sorry, ASH1L. The L is for like, because it's named after Drosophila fruit fly protein. So ASH1L is also a bromodomain containing protein. That makes it number, so I guess that's number five, right? There's a lot of bromodomain proteins that are upstream of DUX4. I mentioned that Michael Kaiba showed that at the University of Minnesota showed that there's several bromodomain containing proteins downstream of DUX4. Okay, so it gets very complicated when you start throwing around bromodomain inhibitors. Okay, so that's where Rosvare logic comes in, and the word selective. That's the key word here, is that is their wheelhouse. They, all these bromodomains that are out there are very similar. They're about 110 amino acids. They have the same sort of crystal structure. We've actually been toying around looking at some of these crystal structures. And what you find is they all kind of overlap, but there are there's some differences. So the question is, can you find the right one that's required for knocking down DUX4 the best and without too many regulating too many other genes, right? You may focus on DUX4, but if you find a drug that shuts down DUX4 expression, but also shuts down expression of other things that are very important, that's not really helpful in the clinic. That's what we would call no path to clinic, okay? Fine in the lab, good to the lab, not good in the clinic. So your first thing you want to find, targets that are going to shut down DUX4, and then also, the bromodomain, you need to find a very specific inhibitor of that. Okay, so that you're not knocking down a whole bunch of other bromodomains you're inactivating a whole bunch of other bromodomain proteins, right? You want to be as specific as you can. Now, this is going to be really hard. And it's funny, I was talking with a medicinal chemist friend of mine, one of the smartest guys I know. These medicinal chemists are amazing, right? Their job is to take what we find in the lab that are good tools in cell culture and turn them into drugs that can be given to people. And that's easier said than done, okay? Because it's just quite complicated. Without getting into it, it's quite complicated. But what he told me, he said, basically, because I'm always focused on specificity. He's like, every drug out there, specificity is a tough thing. You can actually talk yourself out of anything, right? Because, there's going to be a million potential side effects. All these drugs affect different multiple pathways. You start multiple genes, multiple components, different genes in different cells, but you just got to do it anyway and give it a try. Because every once in a while, what do you know? It works. Because it really comes down to dosage and toxicity and side effects, right? Is the benefit of the drug, is that better than the potential side effects? See all these drug ads on TV and you see this whole list of side effects that's just the nature of the business, right? Now, if you want something that only knocks down DUX4, well, that's what the antisense is about. That's where, that's what the gene therapy is about, okay? And those are FSHD specific. But if you want to take a pill, small molecule drug, you're probably going to have to just accept the fact that it's not perfect. If you shut down DUX4, and hopefully what other side effects, and this is what lesmopamod, right? Lesmopamod takes out P38 signaling. They're hopefully doing a dose that only that predominantly leads to decrease of DUX4 expression, but P38 is required for a whole lot of other things. And if you completely eliminate P38 expression, well, you're not gonna have FSHD is gonna be the least of your problems. Okay, so it's this window. You find this dosing window, right, where you can get therapeutic benefit from reduction of DUX4. Without causing more problems. And it's the same thing here with the BET inhibition, okay? So they've made the selective BET inhibitor called apabetalone. It only, now as opposed to JQ1, this only binds bromodomain 2s. It's a BD2, and it predominantly seems to be functioning through this protein called BRD4. And so now you've suddenly got, now you're getting safer, right? Things are getting better. And that's what's really important. It has been in clinic. It's called RVX-208. It has been in clinic for arteriosclerosis, something called major adverse cardiac events, where it's been able to show reduction in major adverse cardiac events and reduce risk in some people. So there has been some chronic in clinic dosing with apabetalone for other indications. So they know some level of what they're going to refer to in this paper as a clinically relevant dose, which they're going to say is 5 micromolar, based on these other studies. Now, is it relevant for FSHD or not? Not clear. But it's a well-tolerated dose in the clinic for these other indications. And so and they know they're going to have fewer kind of fewer alternative targets are going to be affected because bromodomain 1 and these other classes of bromodomain proteins should still be able to function normally. So they're narrowing down the problems while maintaining the idea of shutting down DUX4. Okay, so that's what they're going to do. All right, so we're going to dive into the paper. Let's see, I got to get my notes together. So in the interest of trying to keep things short, I'm going to give you, we're going to take a short break right now. I got REM, Everybody Hurts. I was going to go with End of the World as We Know It, but you know what? It's always the end of the world. It's, you know, honestly, every day is the end of the world as we know it. And the new day comes up and you deal with it, right? So that's fine. So we're going to go with Everybody Hurts, and I'll be back and I'm going to take you through the paper, and then we're going to talk a little bit about some CRISPR work. All right, be back in 1 sec. Yeah. That's REM, Everybody Hurts, from 1992's Automatic for the People. Great band out of Athens, Georgia. And I don't know, I love them. They only formed in 1980, and I think they went all the way up into the 2000s. So, yeah, it's kind of 80s music, but I love it. All right, man. So let's dive into the paper, and you're going to hear some paper jostling because I took some notes to try to keep me more concise. Okay, so apabetalone, a clinical stage selective BET inhibitor, opposes DUX4 target gene expression in primary human FSHD muscle cells from Resveratrix. So overall, you know, we talked about the bromodomains and BET proteins, BET inhibition. The general idea, right, is that bromodomain proteins containing the BD2 domain or BD1 domain, BET family of bromodomains, were previously shown by Franz Vedrick, Stephen Tapscott, and our own group to be involved in the regulation of expression of DUX4 in FSHD muscle cells. Okay, they are positive regulators of DUX4 expression. And if you knock them down using antisense, you can actually repress DUX4 and DUX4 target gene expression. The idea here is, so bromodomains, they bind that acetylated lysine. And so the idea is to make a small molecule that fits into the groove and prevents the bromodomain from binding the acetylated lysine on the histone or other chromatin-associated protein at the FSHD gene locus on the DUX4 gene and prevent the formation of transcriptional activation complex, or one way or another, not getting into mechanism, preventing DUX4 mRNA expression, right? That's the idea, okay? So, you know, it's got strong rationale. You know, it's kind of interesting that, you know, our lab, but you know, it's and everything in FSHD, you know, it is hard to find really widely consistent data. So, you know, the Amy Campbell paper in 2017 from Tapscott and Svedrup's groups, you know, they basically identified BRD4 as the best BET protein for DUX4 inhibition, and then the second best was BRD2. Our group, we published in 2018, actually did the work in collaboration with a biotech company in 2014. We found that BRD2 and BRD3 were the best targets. Doesn't matter. A number of groups showed that JQ1, a drug that binds bromodomain 1 and bromodomain 2, block expression of DUX4 or prevent expression of DUX4. But, you know, this is considered a pan-BET inhibitor, because it inhibits all the BET family of proteins. And the rationale here is to try apabetalone, because apabetalone only binds BD2 domains. It primarily functions through BRD4. You know, it's already in the clinic for a chronic treatment. In fact, it is the only BET inhibitor currently in the clinic for chronic treatment. Typically, BET inhibition is thought of for cancer, and JQ1 is a cancer drug. Okay, so that's the benefits, you know, so the positives of the paper, the only BET inhibitor currently used chronically in the clinic. Not quite as chronically as maybe for FSHD, but, you know, regardless, it's more chronic than the others. It's more specific than JQ1. It shows better tolerability, lower toxicity in the clinic. I already know this from patients, some data. So this is going to be a repurposing of a drug, so that's kind of cool. It's in the clinic for arteriosclerosis and major adverse cardiac events. So these are non-malignancies. They are not cancer indications, you know. So that's good because, you know, again, FSHD is different. You know, what are the negatives? Well, of course, there's negative, you know, specificity. You know, to me, the specificity is not so much around the drug. The specificity is that if you knock out BRD4 activity, and eventually we'll knock out BRD2 and BRD3 activity, and probably BRDT as well, you're going to not just affect DUX4, but you will affect many other genes in the genome. That's just the nature of the business. But again, that's true for all small molecules. You know, the question is, do you get therapeutic benefit at what the dose you're trying? And you know, what is the list of side effects and the potential adverse effects? And then you weigh it. Is the therapeutic benefit worth, you know, more valuable than whatever these off target or these other target side effects are. Okay. So what is BRD known to be for? Well, you know, it's actually very important in inflammation and innate immunity. It's important in the interferon beta pathway for anti-tumor activity. You know, it just regulates many genes besides DUX4. But knocking it down is going to give you less, you know, with epobetalone, it'll be much more specific than JQ1. So, you know, you're improving the conceptual, you know, approach, right? You're taking BET inhibition, which really was going to be difficult to get to clinic for FSHD, considering the chronic nature of the disease, and you're getting a more specific inhibitor that has better tolerability in the clinic and fewer effects on the genome. Okay, so that's the idea. So then they're going to test apobetalone in FSHD1 myoblast line. So these are, you know, there's they're going to get lines from Coriell repository. This is a government repository run, I believe, by NIGMS. And there's some FSHD cell lines that were deposited many, many years ago by Melanie Ehrlich. And one of the benefits of getting these cell lines is that basically anybody can just buy the cell lines and you pretty much can use them. And nobody knows, since it's a government repository, no one in the field will know that you wanted FSHD cells. It's a way to keep your program stealth. The other issue is, not just stealth, is that, you know, as an academic, I have access to many, many places to get cells. I can get them from the Wellstone repository at UMass Med, the Field Center at University of Rochester Medical School, you know, Silver Vandermeer Lab, Stephen Tapscott Lab, you know, actually, Vincent Mouly in France. I mean, actually, there are many, many places. And actually, company, you know, and I'll get them and they'll be free. We just have a material transfer agreement. Normally, there's some sort of agreement, you know, one agreement. One part of the agreement is that we won't give them to companies, for-profit companies. So academics, you know, we share reagents. Now, once a for-profit company gets involved, no, everything changes, right? And every place has different level of demands. And I got to tell you, some of the demands are so insanely high that they have prevented biotech companies from actually getting into the FSHD space. Companies have contacted me and said, we can't get a hold of any cells with any sort of reasonable fee structure. Now, it turns out you actually generally, at least I know the University of Rochester Medical Center and Leiden, they're pretty good. In fact, very good at making very reasonable deals of selling the cells to for-profit companies. And also the Fred Hutch Cancer Center is very easy to work with and we've got experience. That's the Tapscott Lab cells, making those available to, you know, academic and industry as well. So, you know, there are some of these very good as I'm talking, I guess, because I talk about the ones that I know are very good. Not everybody though, they're actually in, there are some repositories that really, really, are difficult to work with if you're in a for-profit company. Now, I understand there's a cost to making the cells, right? But ultimately, in the end, these cells all came from a person, and no matter what repository has the cells, and I believe the deal that you make with anybody making a donation is that a muscle, which is, you know, can be quite traumatic, to get a muscle biopsy, needle biopsy, open biopsy. The deal you're making is that the people taking that biopsy are going to do everything in their power to make to cure your disease, right? And part of that is making the cells available to the community, you know, reasonably. Now, on the other hand, some of the maybe companies don't want any of these, you know, all these places have FSHD research groups, and maybe companies don't want anyone to know they're doing it. You know, that's up to a company. But you know, regardless. It is still frustrating that I still get calls from people, from companies that say, we can't get a hold of cells, to do our research program. Can you help us out or point us in the right direction? I've actually know, and I probably shouldn't say who, some companies have had to actually get their own biopsies and make their own cell lines so that they can do their work in the FSHD space, because they could not make a reasonable deal with some of the repositories. And that, and I know firsthand that, you know, a case where that costs 6 months or more in the program that set the company behind. And so, you know, this is kind of some of the dirty underbelly of the field. But anyway, so I'll bring it up because these guys went into Coriel. You say, why doesn't everybody go to Coriel? Because these cells suck. Okay. They just suck. That's why nobody uses them. I mean, they may have been fine way back when, but you can't culture these things forever. We've had them in our lab. They just don't work very well. You still see them in the literature. I wish someone would have advised them to make a better deal with somewhere. And normally you can find, you just have to know your way around, or maybe sometimes get people in the right door. Actually, it's a place where foundations could leverage their power and tell these academic groups or these institutions that they damn well better straighten up and fly right and make good deals with companies on these patient-derived cells, or else they're not going to fund those groups anymore. Foundations could actually force this to happen, but they're chicken shit and they won't. This has been a complaint of mine for a long time. Anyway, so why do I bring this up about the paper? Because not only are they using a suboptimal cell line, they actually got two lines, but most of the paper is only done in one cell line. FSHD has got tremendous variability. If you get 10 different cell lines in FSHD, you will have 10 different levels of DUX4 expression. You will have different kinetics of the DUX4 expression, and you'll have different epigenetics at the locus. You will have different genetics at the locus. You will have different modifier mutations. And so in FSHD, if you're going to be working on FSHD, you need to do multiple cell lines of FSHD1, also FSHD2, and you really need to have related healthy controls to look at the effects. They don't have any of that. Okay, so that's one of my big complaints. My other big complaint about this paper is that they're working on FSHD and they never once look at DUX4 mRNA expression. Okay, that's the big knock. They look at DUX4 target genes. And one thing we know in my lab, you know, we've probably looked at, I don't know, maybe a dozen different FSHD cell lines. The DUX4 target genes are highly variable themselves. They are not just DUX4 targets. They are also regulated by other factors in cells. They can be regulated by other DUX4 target genes. So a DUX4 it's a transcriptional activator. It can activate another a gene A, and that gene A then can actually activate other genes. And then you get rid of DUX4, well, if gene A is still on, it's regulating the so-called DUX4 target genes. There are direct targets, indirect targets, and some that are both. Okay, so we always, at least in my lab, we always look at DUX4 mRNA directly because that's supposedly the target, right? And they don't look at that. So, you know, that's kind of, I'm a little concerned about number of cell lines. So lacking in power, lacking in rigor, and they're actually not looking at the one thing that they actually really need to be looking at. Okay. All right. So, you know, and I got to tell you, in cell culture, there's no excuse for it. Be able to do DUX4 mRNA qRT-PCR. Now, I'll get to this at the end after I'm done about this, but a lot of companies may not know the proper way. Companies, you know, there becomes a technical issue for how to analyze gene expression. And we have just learned, I've consulted for an awful lot of companies, and companies like to do things kind of in use technology they're comfortable with. They don't necessarily like bringing in new assays. And I got to tell you, the DUX4 mRNA quantitative reverse transcriptase PCR assay, you know, it's involved, but it works really well. Okay. We do it all the time in our lab, do it on everything in our lab. Okay. So now we're going to say, okay, strong promise for the paper. Concerned about some of the way they're going to go about it. Anyway, so what's the system? So they're going to take their cells, they're going to differentiate these cells, and then they're going to add drug. Right? So this is actually great because you're different, you know, muscle cells replicate. These are kind of muscle precursor cells and muscle satellite cells. And then they differentiate where these muscle cells fuse and elongate into fibers. Now, most of your skeletal muscle is actually already differentiated muscle. You have little niches of stem cells that are replicating. And when you get damage or you get injury or you need to regrow muscle, those cells replicate and they fuse into your muscle, okay? So the target tissue in FSHD is generally differentiated muscle. So they're going to treat that with their drug. but also they're going to do it a second way. And this is really good, not positive of the paper. They're going to also add the drug during differentiation. Now, I often find companies do it one way or the other, because this is twice the work. And they're going to add it during differentiation. Two reasons I can imagine. One, that's kind of when DUX4 is getting turned on. And two, this is a small molecule drug. Maybe, some people do claim that DUX4 is expressed in these replicating myoblasts. I don't believe it for a second. Never once have we found DUX4 expressed in a undifferentiated myoblast, and nobody has published that ever, but you'll still hear about it. But whatever, they're covering all their bases. So they're going to use 5 micromolar apabetalone. I just throw that out there as the number. It doesn't mean much to you, but the point is that is what they call a clinically relevant dose of apabetalone. Cool. Okay. It has an IC50 of 1.2. So it should be a pretty good workable dose in the lab. And then they're going to compare this with JQ1, the PAN inhibitor, right, at 100 nanomolar, which is actually kind of high for JQ1. And then they're going to compare with losmapimod. You guys all know losmapimod. That's the drug that Fulcrum Therapeutics has taken to clinic. It's in phase 3 right now. That is a P38 inhibitor. So apabetalone is a BET inhibitor. So BET proteins that regulate activation of DUX4 block those. P38 kinase signaling is also reported to activate DUX4. So you block either one of those pathways, two different pathways to get the activation of DUX4. But they're going to compare. Basically, how good is this compared to lasmapimod? Okay, I think that's a great idea. However, they're going to use 10 micromolar lasmapimod, which is 100 to 300 times higher than the level that you need to use in the literature. Okay, in our lab, it's around 30 nanomolar. Let's say you went up to 100 nanomolar, but they're using 10 micromolar. I got no idea where they come up with this absolutely insanely high number. And why does that matter? Because you want to compare clinically relevant doses of these drugs. And if you're just going to throw one off the cliff with some insane dose, well, you just kind of limit the actual value of the thing, of the experiment. Okay, then they're going to look at DUX4 target genes 6 days post-differentiation. Now, I put a question mark next to this. I got to tell you, in our lab, after differentiating, DUX4 goes up and then it comes down. Okay. After differentiation, DUX4 target genes follow DUX4 expression and go up. And they kind of have their own. It's always very little bit different on how they come down. They're all somewhat different. Their data in this paper does not replicate at least what we find in the lab, but it's how they work. The kinetics are different in these cells. Now, it doesn't say that they're wrong, but this is why you need to use multiple cell lines to make sure you're not chasing your tail when you're in the lab. Okay. All right. Then they're going to use losmapimod, and interestingly, they find that while apabetalone at 5 micromolar does a pretty good job of decreasing DUX4 target genes. Now, remember, DUX4 is a transcriptional activator. It turns on a whole bunch of other genes in the genome. They're assaying a couple of these genes as a surrogate marker for DUX4 being on. Works pretty well. Great. 10 micromolar lasmapimod, basically in the differentiated cells, doesn't work at all. Now, if that's actually true, that's a disaster for lasmapimod. I actually don't know if that's actually true, but that's what they got. But then they're going to, when they do the differentiating cells and they do the second type of assay, they find that 100 nanomolar lasmapimod, again, does not have a large effect, okay? It's doing better. It works, oddly enough, the 10 micromolar works really well. 100 nanomolar, which is the clinically relevant dose, does not actually have a large effect on DUX4 target gene expression. And the other question mark I have is JQ1 does not affect myogenesis. Now, I bring these things up because, apabetalone in their system, whether it's differentiated cells or cells that are undergoing differentiation with treatment, it works great. But lasmapimod's not working like it's published to work. It doesn't work. Our lab works very differently than what they're seeing. JQ1 is not functioning the way it's worked. And our lab works on JQ1 as well. And it's not. So I'm just kind of concerned because, what is published on multiple cell lines by multiple groups is not being recapitulated in this study. So I'm not sure how to actually interpret the apabetalone data, which looks really good. Again, you know, company's going to publish, you know, so publish something that looks really good. So overall, yes, apabetalone appears to decrease DUX4 target gene expression in one cell line. Okay. And it does not have adverse effects on muscle differentiation. Great. Negative of this so far, only two genes were assayed. JQ1 and losmapimod are acting strange. The cultures are strange. The dead drugs are strange, or the cells are strange. I don't know. Major problem I still have, only one cell line and no healthy cells to see how it's being affecting. Okay. So then they're going to then move on and they're going to actually do an experiment that I love, really good experiment. A lot of people don't do it, although more and more getting into it, is they're going to do RNA-seq. So now they're going to look at the full transcriptome, all the genes that are expressed in these cells when they treat them with drugs. Do the assay. That's really great. They're going to look at the DUX4 signature. And the details matter. They're using one cell line and doing everything in triplicate. So they're doing one cell line. That's FSHD1, no healthy cells, and so very poor rigor, low power. All right. So now they're going to start throwing on different. And they did this earlier on. Is they're going to they use 5 micromolar apabetalone, but they also sometimes use 5 times as much, which I don't believe is a clinically relevant dose. But what they're going to do is they're going to say, well, we're tapping it with a hammer, and if that doesn't get us the result we want, we're going to hit it with a sledgehammer and see if that gives us the result we want. Well, if that's not relevant to the clinic, then who gives a damn? So I'm going to focus on the 5 micromolar apabetalone, and unfortunately, we have to compare it to 10 micromolar losmapimod, which is an insanely high level or dose of losmapimod. It's almost as if they're trying to make losmapimod look bad. I'm not saying they are, but at least that would be the... It would be the better motivation than saying we just weren't capable of figuring out what the clinically relevant dose is. Okay, so that's the big negative. So losmapimod suddenly, well, at 10 micromolar in these studies, seems to work pretty well. At least the one that now they did do it again both ways. They've looked at differentiated myotubes and such. And JQ1, losmapimod, and apabetalone all seem to decrease DUX4 gene signature, right? So there are 3 different studies that they're looking at, done by different groups, that say this is what happens and when you overexpress DUX4 in cell culture, or this is the DUX4 signature from FSHD muscles. And, you know, they don't completely agree, but in general, actually they do a really good job because they compare apabetalone treatment to all of these different data sets. And they show, in general, all the DUX genes that are increased in expression by DUX4 or an FSHD tend to come back to zero. Now, the negative or the question I have is also, you know, DUX4 is known to repress some genes. And those and the genes that are repressed by DUX4 look like they're still down. Okay, which again, if you're just blocking DUX4 expression, everything should go back to normal. But that's what it looks like from that data. However, they then go back and they're going to look at a DUX4 activity score, okay, and show that their 5 micromolar apabetalone, overall, if you look at the whole scope of all the different data sets, actually does return the FSHD1 cells to a non-FSHD transcriptome based on the published data. Losmapimod, they're hitting it really hard, actually not only returns you to a normal level, but then it makes it worse. Goes all the way, you know, if you think about a dial going all the way on the right, going up to zero, all the way now to the left, right? So now you're actually disrupting stuff, and JQ1 does the same thing. But again, they're hitting it with a huge dose. I got to tell you, in the Alejandro Rojas paper from Fulcrum, they actually showed that the correct dosing of losmapimod pretty much very specifically just returned the DUX4 signature, the FSHD signature, and FSHD cells back to a non-FSHD state, just like apabetalone. So I would have liked to have seen that they use the same dose that is published and used and currently in clinic, just to more better validate their system. But it seems that the point of this paper is to say apabetalone is somehow better than losmapimod. I don't know if it is or not, but this data to me is not convincing. Okay. Then they're going to go and do a KEG analysis. This is the Kyoto Encyclopedia of Genes and Genomes, KEGG. And this is a computational form of a biological systems. Okay. They're going to map the molecular products to interactions and reactions. And you're going to be able to relate all of this to networks. Okay. So it's kind of like systems biology. And you're going to treat with a drug and look for enriched pathways, or you're going to take FSHD versus non-FSHD and look for enriched pathways. And that's what Amanda Rickard did from Dan Miller's lab back in 2015. And she came up with a whole bunch of DUX4 dysregulated pathways, okay, and publish that. And so they're going to compare apomodulone treatment, JQ1 treatment, and lasmapimod treatment to the DUX4 upregulated pathways and the DUX4 downregulated pathways. And what they find is it has no effect whatsoever on the DUX4 upregulated pathways, and they only found one pathway in the downregulated pathways, unless if for the 5 micromolar apomodulone, but the 25 micromolar, that actually starts to affect these other pathways. Now, why does that matter? Well, because you're not going to use 25 micromolar apomodulone. You only use 5 micromolar. That's your clinically relevant dose. Okay, if you hit it hard enough, you can start to affect these pathways, which again suggests to me this isn't quite as great a drug as maybe they might hope. But, you know, it's me speaking. There's a ton of data in this paper on the supplemental stuff, but then the final thing they're going to do, that was just the DUX4 dysregulated pathways. They're going to maintain this kind of analysis and look at just pathways in general. What pathways are affected? And they find that, you know, they're going to look at apomodulone, 1 micromolar, 5 micromolar, and 25 micromolar. And then they're going to look at JQ1 and lasmapimod, again, the insanely high level of JQ1. Now, remember, these both affect DUX4, but they also are coming completely different pathways, okay? Lasmapimod, P38 inhibition, apomodulone, BET inhibition. So totally different pathways to get to preventing the activation of DUX4. And they get very different and things that are affected in the cell, very different processes are affected. Now, it's somewhat interesting because JQ1 would block bromodomain 1 and bromodomain 2. Apomodulone only blocks bromodomain 2. So you would think that everything that's in apomodulone would also be in JQ1, but there might be a lot of things in JQ1 that are not in apomodulone. You actually kind of get, yeah, that second part is true. There are a lot of pathways affected by JQ1 that are not affected by the 5 micromolar apomodulone. There's a number of things in the apomodulone that, you know, go in the other direction too. And the striking thing that I just can't quite get my head around is that 1 micromolar apomodulone affects a whole bunch of pathways, okay? They're upregulated. 5 micromolar apomodulone, a lot of those pathways are not affected anymore. Then 25 micromolar, they're not affected anymore either. You think, well, that's kind of odd. A small dose, normally as you increase dose, you actually, you know, so I'm not sure I fully understand how a low dose of apomodulone affects things that a high dose doesn't, unless it's just that it's so non-specifically. I guess the other way to think of it is maybe the clinically relevant dose disrupts so many pathways that you can't find any enrichment, which would suggest that the dosing is going to be kind of a problem. You also see this kind of strange thing where you'll see 1 micromolar has an effect and 25 micromolar have an effect, but 5 micromolar has no effect. Or you see only an effect at one thing in the middle. Anyway, you don't see these gradients. So maybe I don't do this type of pathways very much. But overall, it just strikes me as kind of bothersome. Now, all the data is in the supplemental stuff, and I want to go through that. It seems that a number of pathways are disrupted. If you look at lasmapimod, even with the 10 micromolar, quite honestly, it doesn't look so bad. You know, it's mainly downregulation of pathways, which you might expect. Interestingly, apomodulone is upregulation of pathways. You're knocking out what is generally thought of as gene activators, and you're getting upregulation. Lasmapimod, you're knocking out activation pathways, and you're getting repression. That's more functioning the way I expect. So I'm not really sure I fully understand how apomodulone is truly working the way they think it's working. Anyway, but the data is there, and that's what it is. They then go on, and they looked at it and show that it has no adverse effect on cell viability or apoptosis. And that's that. So that's essentially the paper. Okay. And they conclude, and I'll read directly from the paper. Conclusions. Here we demonstrate that the BD2 selective BET inhibitor apabetalone inhibits DUX4 target gene expression and reverses the transcriptional program that it activates. I would say my interpretation is, to some degree, that is true, with some caveats on the dosing. Furthermore, we showed the differentiated impacts on measures of muscle cell health and function between BD2 selective and pan-BET inhibitors. Okay, the pan-BET's the JQ1. These findings suggest that apabetalone, as the only BET inhibitor tolerated for chronic administration, has a strong potential for the treatment of FSHT. And this is where I would say, you know, if I'm, I mean, I would say this is like step one. I mean, what your step two, let's say it's step two on a long path. Step one was done by other groups showing that, including our own and Tapscott and Zvedrick groups, showing that BET inhibition does affect favorably DUX4 expression. Here they show that a BD2 selective inhibitor, apabetalone, affects target genes. They don't know a dang thing about DUX4 itself. And they know that this happens in an N of 1. And let me tell you, in science, N of 1 is a bad number to have. Okay, you need to this needs to be replicated in other cells, and I'd like to see what this does to healthy muscle as well. And what are the effects on these things? So I just view this as a preliminary study in support that does support further work on apabetalone, but it is a long way, in my opinion, going to clinic. I'm not against it in any way, shape, or form, but I'd like to see some replication. I need to see DUX4. Expression levels, mRNA expression levels. I need to understand the conflicting cell culture data between losmapimod and JQ1. I need to see dosing in an animal model, like a xenograft model would be really good. Of course, obviously that would be kind of another set of experiments. Because quite honestly, this is not nearly as good as the data that Fulcrum had for losmapimod. The losmapimod data, check it out. Check the Rojas paper. I think that may have been skeletal muscle. I'll have to look that up. Check it out. That is actually much better data than what's here. And that still failed in the phase 1-2 or the phase 2B for DUX4 target gene expression. Okay. So if I'm not totally negative, this is me just talking as a interpret, reading the paper. If I were reviewing the paper, I would have had an awful lot of requests of the group before they, I wouldn't have rejected it. Well, I would have said it needs major revision, is what I would have done. Okay. All right. One more thing I want to talk about, something really cool. I can always count on my good friend, Dan Perez, who founded the FSHD Society anyway, Dan is always in the literature. Dan is always looking around, and he sent me something really cool this week that I just wanted to kind of tap on here at the end. And it was something on gene editing, because this is applicable to FSHD. Okay, so you know we do CRISPR inhibition gene therapy, where we return the epigenetic state of the FSHD locus back to a healthy state, right? Because cutting the FSHD region is a really bad idea, okay? We've gone over this before. CRISPR editing is really bad. Okay. But there's something a little bit different, which is called base editing. And you think about base editing, that's more like taking a polyp off if you got like colon cancer. I got a little polyp, clip it off. Everything's still intact and you just clipped it off, right? As opposed to taking out the tumor, like I got like 18 inches of my colon resected, right? That's more like CRISPR cutting, okay? Base editing, flip out, much, much better deal to just clip off a few polyps, right? And so you can change the DNA sequence with CRISPR base editing. And so you say, well, that sounds pretty cool. Why is this not being done for FSHD? Well, I got to tell you, Silver Vandermeer's lab showed that it can be done for FSHD. And he showed that you could actually use these CRISPR Cas9 targeted base editors and change the DUX4 sequence from permissive to non-permissive. Now, you guys all know that that's right. Remember, if you did our research testing, you know that the first test we do is see, do you have an FSHD permissive allele? Everybody with FSHD has a permissive allele, which means you have both parts of the DUX4 gene. You have the coding sequence that's in the D4Z4, and you have the polyadenylation signal that is distal to the D4Z4. Now, if you're non-permissive, you don't have that second part. And a single base change can make you non-permissive, meaning that even if you have the deletion, you can't get FSHD because you can't make DUX4 mRNA and protein. Okay. And so what Silvera showed is it's not very wonderfully efficient, but he showed that you can do proof of concept in cell culture. These base editors can eliminate DUX4 mRNA from cells. Okay. Great. Why is nobody pursuing this? Because these things are huge. Okay. Even the mini ones are big, and they're too big to even go with a mini cast like what Epic Bio has, right? You can't deliver these. Okay, so why is Dan so excited? Well, turns out the FDA just gave clearance to Verve. I don't know if they're Verve Therapeutics, that's just Verve is what I wrote down, to use base editing, CRISPR base editing in the clinic. Okay, and actually back in March, Intellis also got FDA approval to use in vivo CRISPR base editing in the clinic. So they're delivering it. What's going on? Well, Verve is going to look at PCSK9, and they're going to inactivate this gene. So they want to actually clip off some of the DNA sequence and change the sequence. And this is going to make, you know, inactivate this gene. And what this will do is it will decrease your LDL cholesterol if you have familial hypercholesterolemia. Okay. Now that sounds very familiar because, you know what? Inactivating the DUX4 gene is what we want to do. Okay, because changing the sequence and inactivating the gene is always going to be easier than fixing it. And that's what they need to do in FSHD. That's what they need to do in familial hypercholesterolemia. Okay, Intellis is looking at angioedema, which is a swelling disorder. Okay, how are they delivering these? Well, they're not using viruses. See, the virus, the AAV, adeno-associated virus, that we need to use, that Epic Bio needs to use, that Scott Harper needs to use, that all of us doing gene therapy and neuromuscular disease have to use, they have a small cargo capacity. You have to compress everything down and make a mini repressor or a mini Cas. Everything has to be small and fit into a really small genome of cargo. But with a nanoparticle, lipid nanoparticles, you can load those up with really large sequences. Okay, and that's what they're doing. They're loading it up with large sequences. It's going to be safer and it's non-viral, right? You deliver, there's no immune response to these, right? The other thing that they're going to do is they're not going to use a gene and DNA. They're going to load it up with mRNA. Because the other problem with CRISPR editing, any sort of CRISPR cutting, is, and actually I think it's a problem with RNAi as well, this is going to be on your whole life if it's a DNA. If you insert the gene and the gene expresses Cas, think of this as a pair of scissors running around, clipping, or hedge clippers if it's going to be the base editing. These hedge clippers, once they clip off the DUX4 polyadenylation signal, what are they doing for the next 40 years? They're going to find something to clip, and eventually they're going to clip something that's bad. Right? That's DNA. These guys are putting in mRNA. Now, you know what goes DNA to mRNA to protein? They're skipping the DNA. The mRNA has a half-life, so they're going to deliver mRNA. It's going to be translated and make the CRISPR machine to do the editing, and it's going to be only for a short time. It's going to find its target, do the editing, and then it's gone. Poof. Okay? And so, there you go. It's brilliant. It's fantastic. Now, the caveat is these are all done in the liver because, you know what? That's the only place so far, at least commercially and publicly available, these things can be delivered. Okay. Liver diseases are great. Blood diseases are great because you can do delivery in these systems that you can't do to skeletal muscle. So, but I'm excited because, I mean, the technology is moving, and I guarantee you people are working on lipid nanoparticles to get delivery to skeletal muscle. This is going to... Once this is done, we can efficiently deliver nanoparticles to skeletal muscle and deliver. Then now all of a sudden the size restrictions are gone, and it's going to open up a whole nother avenue of therapy. Plus, you're not going to get the immune response where you can only get treated once. I mean, just so you know. So again, it's a case of where the field, just the general field of gene therapy delivery, CRISPR technology, it's all moving forward. Granted, these aren't having anything to do with FSHD yet, but they could be applied to FSHD, and someday they will be applied to FSHD. You never know where that next big technological breakthrough is going to come from. This is really cool. Dan, thanks. I'm really glad Dan finds all of these things. for me and sends him along because he knows what's interesting for the field. You think more people would listen to him. All right, man. So I'm going to be heading on out. I tried to, I always try to keep it short and I can't. I cannot keep it short. But anyway, that's the podcast for that. Our next podcast, we're going to have Jaeger the Kid. He's the house musician and he's going to be going big time. You heard him here first. That'll be our next podcast. In the meantime, all my Jewish friends out there, man, keep your head up. Stay safe. You know what? There's a lot of hate out there, but let me tell you, there's a lot of love out there too. I guess we need to be more vocal with it because, man, we love you all and hope you're doing well. And everybody else out there, regardless of your persuasion, if you're going to condemn terrorism, then we're on your side as well. All right. So, catch you later and, see how my Springboks are going to do. Like a game starts in 10 minutes. All right, man. See you all later.
Thank you for listening to the MyFSHD podcast, where we share with you the latest news and information on FSHD as we strive for a cure. Do you have a question for Peter? He'd love to hear from you. You can reach him at peterjones@med.unr.edu. Thank you for listening, and join us again next time for more news and information.